This is Charlotte Talks. I'm Mike Collins. We all lie. We lie to our families. We lie to coworkers. We lie to pollsters. We lie to ourselves. In the case of the lies I'm talking about, we tell those lies or those fibs because we want to look better than we really are. And over time, we've come to believe certain things about ourselves as individuals and collectively as a society. The trouble is, we've painted ourselves an incorrect picture of who we are. But the truth about who we are, what we think, what we believe, what we desire, is emerging thanks to our online activities. What many of us believe is private as we sit behind our computers surfing the web is actually being aggregated and examined carefully thanks to big data. And the picture that is emerging about who we really are is very different from the one we've been putting out there. What big data knows about us isn't necessarily something we'd volunteer to our neighbors, and we might be afraid to tell our mothers, but it's there. And perhaps it's time we take a good, hard look. Seth Stevens Davidowitz is an op-ed writer for the New York Times and a former Google data scientist. His research uses big data sources to uncover hidden behaviors and attitudes, and he's written about his finding in his book, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. Get ready to be uncomfortable because Seth Stevens Davidowitz is joining us for the hour. Seth, good morning. Thank you for being here.
Good morning. Thanks so much for having me.
If you'd like to join our conversation, you can email us at charlottetalks@wfae.org or search for WFAE on Facebook. Get to us through Twitter at Charlotte Talks. I want to talk with you about how you conduct all this and how you discovered all this. And I was going to begin with that. But given the events of the weekend in Charlottesville, let's start in a different place. Let's begin with a really big lie that we live in a post-racial society. This weekend's events in Charlottesville, in which members of alt-right groups, including neo-Nazis and members of the KKK, participating in a white nationalist rally, clashed with the opposition protesters. And you say that you knew we had a simmering racial problem even while Barack Obama lived in the White House. Through your research, you discovered that racism is alive and well. And this weekend, obviously, that boiled over. Could you have predicted that, too? Is this just the tip of a spear?
Yeah, well, I think there was a period, you know, it seems so long ago, when we thought we did live in a post-racial society, or racism was much lower than the truth is. And you can see online, even when people were telling pollsters that they weren't racist or didn't care that Barack Obama was black or all these politically correct truths, online, they were telling a different story. They were making racist searches, usually for jokes mocking African Americans, with kind of shocking frequency. And I also studied Stormfront, which is the biggest hate site in the most popular hate site in the United States, and learned about both how popular it was and also the demographics of it. That it was kind of young people, which you also saw at the protests. At the events in Charlottesville, a lot of younger people, neo-Nazis. You know, I think a lot of people didn't realize these people existed, but I've been known this for many years through this internet research.
Yeah, I'd not heard of Stormfront before, probably this weekend, to be honest with you, but you wrote about it in the New York Times in 2014 and in your book as well.
I actually found out about it because they were discussing my research. I was Googling myself, actually, and I found that there was this site that kind of monitored Jewish writers, and I didn't know it existed. And then I found out that it was, you know, 300,000 people were visiting it every month, you know, and I analyzed all the data of it, kind of scraped all the membership information, and found out all these young people were becoming obsessed with this neo-Nazi material online. The clear cause of it was Barack Obama. The biggest increase in membership in Stormfront by far was the night that Obama was first elected. So it really is a response to Obama's presidency.
Of course, we don't know how many people who are involved in the situation in Charlottesville follow Stormfront or go to the website often. We don't know if the fellow who drove the car into that crowd and killed a person was a Stormfront person. But Stormfront members, you write, tend to be young, at least according to self-reported birth dates. The most common age at which people join the site is 19. and four times more 19-year-olds sign up than 40-year-olds. What is it about 19 and 20 and 21-year-olds? What is it about that?
I think it's a very impressionable group, and it's not a – I think another thing that's also surprising is it's not a stupid or uneducated group. You know, the most popular interest of Stormfront members are is reading. They're very obsessed with various philosophers and evolution, and they're political junkies. They read the New York Times a lot. They're very kind of an educated intellectual group, but very for some reason younger people tend to be drawn by these types of messages. One of the interesting things, one of the things I found most interesting is when they report why they first joined Stormfront, many people say that it was a dating experience. So an African-American perhaps dated someone that they wanted to date, and it created kind of this rage that that led them to this material.
Yeah, you say that their page views, I guess, at stormfront.com. I guess that's their address. I don't want to give it out necessarily, so who cares? But that the single biggest increase in membership in their history at Stormfront was by far November the 5th, 2008, the day after Barack Obama was elected president. But Google searches, just in general, dating back to Barack Obama's first election, revealed concerns about race. There's an uptick in the searches for the N-word. And not as many searches for first black president. What did that tell you?
I think there was just a rage that, as you kind of mentioned, was simmering underneath, conventional politically correct society that wasn't revealing itself in polls or in normal TV interviews. But a lot of people really were outraged by Obama's election. In much larger numbers than many people would have guessed, and were looking for some outlet for this, but whether it's websites or eventually a politician, as we saw in 2016.
Did the President Obama, did he know this about what was going on the internet? Did Democrats know this? Did people in the government know this? Or is this something that you learned because this is what you do?
Yeah, I think it's sometimes hard to imagine because if I think traditionally people have just assumed to learn about society, you ask people in surveys. So Barack Obama had a team of pollsters, and they asked, "Do you care that Barack Obama is black?" And very, very few Americans, a tiny percentage, said that they cared. So I think that would have been the end of the story traditionally. So I think and these new methods weren't necessarily respected or considered. They were considered a little bit too weird and different. How can we mine just what people are doing on the internet? That's not really considered the way to understand the human psyche. So it wasn't really, didn't really get that much attention.
Plus, people lie to surveys, which we're going to talk about as we go through this conversation. Let's talk about you for a second, because you are convinced that Google searches are the most important data set ever collected on the human psyche. You used to be a Google data scientist. Is that why you say that?
Well, I actually started this research before I was a Google data scientist when I was doing my PhD in economics. And I just became obsessed with all you could learn from this data. It's all anonymous and aggregate. But it started with this racism research where because people were lying to polls and saying they weren't racist, and you compare that to the Google searches people are making – it was just so clear that there was a very different truth about society that was being missed by the traditional way of understanding people. And I started researching more and more areas, whether it's sexuality or abortion or child abuse or depression or anxiety, just so many areas. And I was finding truths revealed by our anonymous and aggregate Google searches that were not revealed by the traditional methods.
And when did this all start for you? What year was this?
I think this was about 2012 where I started, so about 5 years ago.
Some of the information that can be gleaned from our collective Google searches is shocking, even damning, such as the racist attitudes that many, many more people than we thought actually hold. How much of that information can be traced directly back to individuals versus none of it?
None of it. I think that is really important because you also have to realize that any particular search, even the most incriminating search, imaginable. We don't know why a particular person makes a search, right? They may just be doing research. I was writing a book. I can guarantee you I put some things in my Google search bar that wouldn't look so good if someone saw it. But I think – so I think it's really, really important that nobody knows what an individual search is. No researcher knows what an individual search is. But even if – but in aggregate, if we know that a lot of people are making this search in West Virginia or Pennsylvania or Ohio – that tells us something about who we are as a society. So it's all kind of mining the aggregate data,
also,
not any individual data.
Because I do this every day because of what I do, and I put things into a search engine that I would never do personally because I don't care personally. I have to do some certain things here that I have to know about. At some point in time, could that be connected to an individual? I mean, it's being collected. They know your IP address. Could at some point in time this stuff be attached to an individual?
I think, you know, if you were planning a terrorist attack online, that may, you know, I don't know exactly, you know, what Snowden revealed about what they can do with that information. But I'm pretty sure if you're not doing anything illegal or, you know, planning anything deeply illegal, you're fine.
So you're getting this, you're accessing this information, I guess is the key word there, through something called Google Trends, among other things. What is Google Trends and what information does it give you?
Yeah, so it just tells you, it compares the rates at which people make different searches in different parts of the United States. So an example, so you can put in anxiety and it'll tell you how many people make searches related to the health condition anxiety, so anxiety symptoms or anxiety help or anxiety what do I do or many, many similar searches. And then it'll just see, okay, what parts of the country or the world are making these searches in higher numbers, what parts of the country are making it in lower numbers, when have these searches been the highest, when have they been lowest. And just that particular search, you already start learning interesting patterns. For example, anxiety has about doubled in the last 5 years. Anxiety, despite conventional wisdom that it's high, some people think that anxiety is highest among overeducated, neurotic city intellectuals. It's not true at all. Anxiety is highest in Kentucky and Maine and rural areas with fewer people with higher levels of education.
Do we know why? Can Google tell us that?
One thing that actually you can see that's really striking is the recent rise in anxiety and panic attacks mm-hmm. almost perfectly tracks rises in searches for opiate withdrawal and various things related to opiates. So I think drugs have played a role, particularly in rural areas, in the recent rise in anxiety and panic.
And aren't those drugs being taken in some way to self-medicate against anxiety?
Yeah, I think they could be. I think they probably go both ways. They probably are caused by an increased anxiety, but they also move towards increase panic attacks and anxiety.
So we're going to talk a lot about what you've discovered here, and some of it is really unpleasant and unflattering. But could we use Google Trends? Could we search the internet databases, this big data stuff, and find out what is making people so anxiety-ridden and address those problems?
Oh, yeah, definitely. I think, you know, another thing is so what caused it, where it's highest, where maybe we need more health resources, where we need more therapists, all kinds of things we can learn from this data.
Seth,
and help our society.
Seth Stevens-Davidowitz is a New York Times op-ed contributor and the author of Everybody Lives, Big Data, Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. We're going to talk about racism and sex and other things when we come back. Stay with us. It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members at Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord, offering a summer selection of vehicles new and used. Details at Hendrick Volkswagen of Concord at the Hendrick Automall, Concord Mills, or HendrickVW of Concord.com. And Grandfather Mountain. Grandfather Mountain is a scenic nature preserve located off the Blue Ridge Parkway, offering wildlife habitats, hiking trails, and more. Grandfather.com. Well, Charlotte is a hotspot for human trafficking. North Carolina is a top 10 state for the practice, and given our geographic position, we're prime territory. Young people are particularly vulnerable to this, and some Charlotte groups are jumping in to respond. One is working to train professionals to identify at-risk youth, and we're going to hear more about what they're doing and about other steps being taken to thwart this unsavory activity on this program tomorrow at 9.
Everything you know about passwords?
Must be minimum 12 characters.
One uppercase letter.
One lowercase letter.
At least one numeric digit.
At least one special character.
Yeah, all that's wrong.
Traditional guidance is producing passwords that are easy for bad guys and hard for legitimate users.
I'm Audie Cornish. New, much easier guidance on passwords this afternoon on All Things Considered from NPR News.
Today from 4 to 6:30 on 90.7 WFAE, Charlotte's NPR News source.
It's Charlotte Talks on listener-funded 90.7 WFAE and 90.3 WFHE. I'm Mike Collins. We're talking about lies and the lying liars that tell them. That sounds like an Al Frankenbrook book. Seth Stevens-Davidowitz is here. He's the author of Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. He's a New York Times op-ed contributor and a PhD economist from Harvard, who is also a Google data scientist. Why do we feel okay lying to surveys and pollsters, even in an anonymous situation where they cannot connect us individually to our answers? Why do we feel okay about lying to that, but we feel no compunction about telling the complete and absolute truth to Google through our searches?
So I think a big problem with surveys is you have no incentives to tell the truth. So in that situation, people just lean in the direction. We're in a habit of lying to make ourselves look better, and that kind of carries over to surveys. But with Google, you have an incentive to tell the truth to get the information you need. So for example, if you say – if somebody asks you, are you going to vote in an upcoming election, you have no incentive to tell a survey whether you're going to vote or not. You have no reason to tell them the truth. But you have a reason to search Google for information on voting, how to vote, where to vote, register to vote, polling places, polling locations. And these searches can predict with great accuracy where turnout's going to be high or low in a given election.
Do you worry if we've been living – if we've been fooling ourselves, lying to ourselves, and we're thinking that we are a post-racial society, that we're a more open society about all kinds of things – and yet we in our heart of hearts know that we're not like that. We are doing these racist searches or whatever, homophobic searches, whatever it may be. And we feel like a tiny, tiny speck of a minority. And suddenly your book comes along and we find out that we've all been lying to ourselves and we're not the nice people that we say we are. Does that embolden us as the person that felt like this tiny speck all alone in the dark in a computer at a computer terminal?
It's interesting. I hadn't really thought of that. It is maybe somewhat of a concern. So I usually think of the internet. There are many areas where you think it's clearly good for people to learn that there are a lot of people like them. So homosexuality is one area where I think a lot of people, and I talk about in the book, there are clearly a lot more gay men in places where it's harder to be gay in the United States, in like Mississippi and Alabama and Tennessee, than are openly gay. And I think a lot of gay men, both in learning this and in just reaching out on the internet in general, have found that they're less alone than they thought. But I guess you could also say that neo-Nazis have found that there are others like them on the internet. So I think in general, data isn't good or bad. It's just powerful. I think one thing that is clearly good about this data is from a research perspective, having this information. We can learn what causes racism and what causes anxiety and what causes a lot of these problems in society where the traditional data has, because it has been inaccurate, hasn't led to accurate research, I think.
Hmm. Nationally, a lot of Americans would associate racist attitudes with the South. And you found that that's also not accurate. It's not a North-South divide here. You discovered that racism is alive and well and living mostly in the East, but not in the West.
Yeah, that's right. So it definitely is. It definitely is. So if you look at kind of the predominant expression of racism online, it's for jokes mocking African Americans. I mean, just a certain shocking frequency, this kind of entertainment, kind of humiliating black people. It is one of the places this is highest. There are many areas of the South where these searches are highest, in places like southern Mississippi and southern Louisiana. but just as high are many parts of the North in industrial Michigan or upstate New York or western Pennsylvania. And as you say, the real divide is not North versus South. It's East versus West, much higher east of the Mississippi River than west of the Mississippi River.
And you uncovered that how? How did you discover that?
By seeing the search volumes for these racist searches, usually racist jokes for African Americans.
And can you correlate that information, that knowledge, with anything else, any other trends in society?
Yeah, so it correlates almost perfectly with various political behaviors. So it's a strong predictor of way back when places that did not support Obama as much as other Democratic candidates. And it's the single highest predictor that anybody could find for support for Donald Trump in the Republican primary, these racist searches on Google.
I mean, this is aggregate data, but can you, using that big data, can you quantify the number of racists or white supremacists or neo-Nazis among us?
I think it's a little bit hard to go to absolute numbers here. You can kind of say that, there are at least 10% of white Americans did not vote for Obama just because he's black, my research suggests. But that's kind of the lower bound. It could be a lot higher, the overall number of people who are racist.
You've been able to deduce some decidedly uncomfortable, ugly things about prejudice. African Americans, you say, are the only group accused of being rude. I'm not sure. You can talk about how you discovered that in a second. But they're the only group accused of being rude. Nearly every group is called stupid, except for Jews and Muslims. They are tagged with the word evil, as are gays, Mexicans, Asians, and Christians. But Muslims are the only group stereotyped as terrorists. So how did you uncover all of that, and how widespread are these instances of name-calling?
Yes, that's another example where it's an uncomfortable truth. People don't like to say they judge people based on their religion or their race, but you do see in Google searches the stereotypes that people express about different groups. As you say, they're not necessarily things we're proud of, but I think it's good knowing this. And I've done a lot of research on actually what can change these stereotypes, which is not easy, but there do seem to be strategies for changing the negative stereotypes of a group.
Christians, who are in the majority, one would think, in this country as a religious set of beliefs, have often said, many of them have said, that they feel persecuted in this country. And I am honestly surprised that you say they are tagged with the word evil along with gays, Mexicans, and Asians. Did that surprise you?
Yeah, it definitely did surprise me. I think, some of these findings are a little bit maybe politically incorrect, you could say, or surprising. They go against conventional wisdom, but, I think it's good to know this type of
and
stuff.
And can you tell what group is saying what about the other group? In other words, can you tell what group is calling Jews evil or what African Americans rude? Can you tell?
Since you don't know what an individual about any individuals, that's a little harder. You can get some suggestive ideas based on the demographics of cities, but you don't know for sure. What groups are judging the different groups.
You write about the speech that President Obama gave about terrorism in the aftermath of the San Bernardino shootings. He gave a primetime address that was praised by both the New York and the L.A. Times as tough and calming and powerful and moving, and yet, you say, his words may have had the opposite effect, that the speech may have backfired. Talk about that.
Yeah, so that was after the San Bernardino attack, and there was an explosion of Islamophobia on the internet. And you see all these nasty searches for Muslims are terrorists, or Muslims are evil, or even really disturbing stuff. I hate Muslims, kill Muslims. Just nasty, nasty, scary stuff that people are expressing on the internet. And in the backdrop of this, Obama gives this nationally televised speech, and it's kind of classic Obama, very beautiful, moving. He talked about the responsibility that we have to not judge people based on their religion, to not appeal to fear, to appeal instead to freedom. With Evan Soltas, another researcher, we were looking minute by minute what happened to these nasty Google searches during and after Obama's speech. Did they drop as he explained to us the importance of not judging people based on their religion? And you see, not only did they not drop, they didn't actually stay the same. They rose. There was an explosion of searches for "I hate Muslims" and "kill Muslims" and "no Syrian refugees" and "Muslims are evil." So it seemed like everything Obama was doing, despite the rave reviews, was actually backfiring.
And just over the weekend, we have President Trump, who has now been criticized for not soundly denouncing the people involved in this white supremacist march and the person who was involved in killing, using his car, this individual bystander. How long will it take for us to use Google data to find out what the reaction to that lack of condemnation will bring?
Yeah, so my research thus far has said that Trump actually has not increased white supremacism, white supremacy and neo-Nazism and Stormfront members. Basically, this was the big factor that drove people to this idea was Obama, and Trump's just basically capitalized on it, but he hasn't necessarily increased it. Mm-hmm. But we'll see over time if that changes.
So can we extrapolate, going back to President Obama, from the reaction to his speech after San Bernardino and to the many of the things that he said over the course of his 8 years as president and the manner of that he dealt with things, his very calm, seemingly logical manner, can we extrapolate that that also backfired and led to a backlash that ushered in his polar opposite to the White House?
So I think it did. But I just want to – going back to the San Bernardino speech, at the end of the speech, Obama gave one line that seemed to work better. He said that we have to remember that Muslim Americans are our friends and neighbors. They're our sports heroes, and they're the men and women who will die for our country. And after he said this line, like almost immediately there was an explosion in searches for Muslim athletes and Muslim soldiers, and these stayed the highest for a week afterwards. And I think that kind of suggested – I actually wrote a New York Times column about this – that there's maybe a strategy that works and a strategy that doesn't work for calming hate, that you don't want to lecture people telling them stuff they've heard 1,000 times, but you want to subtly provoke their curiosity and change the way stereotypes you're giving of the group that's causing rage.
You know, they say that knowledge is power, and this is certainly giving us knowledge about the inner workings of most of us here. But maybe in this case, knowledge is not power, because at the end of this New York Times article that you wrote back in 2014, The Data of Hate, in which you talked about Stormfront and the rise in popularity of that organization, you ask at the very end of this column, why do some people feel this way and what is to be done about it? I have pored over data of an unprecedented breadth and depth thanks to our new digital era, and I can honestly offer the following answer. I have no idea.
when I was studying Stormfront, there are a lot of things that you would think would work to control hatred. So economic conditions, for example, we often think that if the economy is growing, then fewer people will be drawn to these hate sites. But you don't see that in the data at all. You don't see that there wasn't a big rise in Stormfront during the Great Recession in places that got hammered by the recession. That didn't seem to play a big role. Another thing you might suggest is exposure to different groups. If we live together, if different groups kind of live together, maybe this will lower hate, but you don't see that in the data. So a lot of the things that we've traditionally thought can lower hate don't seem to work in the data. So, you know, I do hope that because this data is now online and available to researchers, we will use it to figure out what works. But definitely when it comes to calming hatred or lowering hatred or preventing people from becoming neo-Nazis, this is really, really difficult stuff. And some of the traditional answers don't seem to work.
Let me share with you some questions and comments that have been coming in while we've been talking. Chris emails, is it possible that online searches are more a form of catharsis or indulgent venting and less an indication of a person's honest values or ethos? And how can you tell if somebody's searching using negative terms that they agree with those terms? How can you tell all this?
Yeah, again, I don't think that everybody agrees with them, and definitely sometimes there is catharsis, but I think the key is that these searches correlate frequently with offline behavior. So, for example, those anti-Muslim searches I was discussing earlier, they correlate with hate crimes against Muslims. When a lot of people are making these searches, there are going to be more attacks at mosques and more assaults of Muslim Americans. So maybe some people are venting, but clearly some people are also expressing a feeling that they ultimately will act on. And the racist searches that I studied earlier correlate with important voting behaviors. Mm-hmm. So clearly there is more than just innocent venting in these searches. They're predicting real-world actions.
Steve emails, is this data adjusted for the population base of the area from which it is attributed? Or is it attributed? You can look at it.
Yeah, you do know the area. And it is adjusted. So it's the percent of Google searches. So it's controlling for how many Google searches are made in an area. So it's not just the absolute number of searches. It's the rate of searches.
And if I'm not mistaken, one of the tools that you use is Google Trends, and that you can go to google.com/trends and type in almost anything, and it will show you what those searches have been like. Is that not true?
Yeah, that's correct.
Okay. Noel on Twitter, how does using the incognito tab in Google Chrome change the statistics about what people are searching for?
Well, that would still show up in the aggregate data, but again, it's that you wouldn't know an individual, but no researcher knows an individual anyway. So I just want to emphasize this is all anonymous and aggregate data. This
right.
isn't about any
so
individual.
So incognito tab and the similar tab on Firefox and other browsers just allegedly hides you from your ISP or from Google, but not the actual question that you asked.
Yeah, exactly.
Okay.
Exactly.
You say that we can predict all sorts of things by analyzing this data, like the outcome of elections and the unemployment rate. With regard to elections, you say you can tell us who is likely to win simply by the number of people who conduct searches using both candidates' name. In other words, if you search Trump Clinton versus Clinton Trump, what does that tell you?
Yeah, so it's interesting how we sometimes reveal our preferences in subconscious ways that we might not have even thought about. So one question is, can you predict elections based on the Google searches people make? A lot of people have asked me that. And the kind of first approach people use is just how many searches does each candidate get? How many searches does Trump get? How many searches does Clinton get? And that doesn't work for the simple and maybe obvious reason that you might search for Trump because you love him, or you might search for Trump because you hate him. But one thing that does have predictive power is the order in which you search candidates' names. So 26% of searches for Trump also included in the previous election the word Clinton. And the order in which you search the candidates subconsciously gives away with pretty good accuracy which way you're going. So if you think of it as the Trump-Clinton election, if you're searching for Trump-Clinton polls, Trump-Clinton debate, you're probably a Trump supporter. If you're looking for the Clinton-Trump polls, the Clinton-Trump debate, the Clinton-Trump results, you're probably a Clinton supporter.
And if you look at those searches in the 30 seconds we have left in this segment, could you have predicted the outcome of this election? Were there more Trump-Clinton searches?
There were, particularly in parts of the Midwest where Trump did better. But again, we're going to need to see more elections to kind of refine the models. But there definitely is a lot of information based on the internet to predict elections okay. better than polls in the future.
Seth Stevens-Davidowitz is our guest. His book is called Everybody Lies, Big Data, New Data, and What the Internet Can Tell Us About Who We Really Are. And we will continue that quest to finding out who we are in a moment. Support for Charlotte Talks comes from WFAE members and Corkscrew Wine Shop and Bar, located at The View near BB&T Ballpark in Uptown Charlotte, and at Birkdale Village in Lake Norman, offering wine and beer from all over the world. Relax on Cork on Wine, thescrewcrew.com. And Telware, servicing the Carolinas with unified voice, data, and video solutions since 1984, now offering hosted solutions for small businesses. More info at telware.com. Rallies in Charlotte and across the country were held on Sunday in response to the violent weekend in Charlottesville, Virginia, whose governor is calling the death of a counter-protester an act of terrorism. The alleged white supremacist charged with mowing down counter-protesters is due in court as Charlottesville and the nation take stock of a grim 72 hours, and that will be the topic of the conversation coming up in 20 minutes at 10 o'clock during On Point. We'll continue our conversation in just a moment. Stay with us.
My first car was a green two-door Plymouth Satellite, and it was a tank. I mean, this thing was the size of a Winnebago. I'm Korva Coleman from NPR News, and I never did any maintenance on it, and it was rusty, and it looked horrible. But it was my first car. I drove it to high school. I drove it to college. I drove around with it with my first boyfriend. Yeah, that was a good car. Imagine turning that car into my favorite programs.
Get details at WFAE.org. Thanks.
It's Charlotte Talks on WFAE and WFHE. I'm Mike Collins with Seth Stevens Davidovitz, New York Times op-ed contributor and the author of Everybody Lies. It's about big data and how it is revealing the truth. Even perhaps we didn't realize about ourselves, but it's revealing the truth about ourselves. There are a lot of people struggling with how this last election turned out the way it did, and particularly are puzzled by the way Donald Trump seems to be the singular Teflon president. There was another president that was accused of being the Teflon president, but in this case, it really is amazing because some of the things that he has said over the course of the campaign and even as president would have been career-ending for politicians, and it not only doesn't have an effect, it seems to boost his popularity. Could that have been predicted with a deep dive into this big data that people are just fed up? And they like this approach.
I think you do see kind of an anger of political correctness that was maybe building over time. And you kind of do see on the internet many people by themselves do express themselves in very different ways than they do publicly. So I think maybe you could have interpreted that as people want to see someone who's a little less controlled and by the book in the way they talk. And the hatred that people feel towards traditional politicians, I think, is very clear on Google searches, although that's also clear in polls. People also say they hate politicians.
Internet searches for certain seemingly unrelated things to jobs or money can be used to predict the unemployment rate. What kind of searches demonstrate that someone is out of a job or that the unemployment rate is rising or falling or concerning to people?
Yeah, so I was actually looking what Google searches correlate highest with the unemployment rate, because maybe we could use this to predict, to measure the unemployment rate before the official data is released. Mm-hmm. And the highest search in the period I searched, and you can read the actual term in my book, I won't say it on air, but was a pornography site, which kind of makes sense that if people are out of work, they have more time to themselves during the day maybe to watch pornography. And the other searches that were high on the list were solitaire and other games, so kind of leisure that people had more time for when they were out of work. In general, it correlates very highly with the unemployment rate. It's also an interesting new way to measure the economy that maybe hasn't been around before but is important, kind of how much slack there is in the economy, how much are people just playing games during the day or doing other things rather than doing work.
Are other economists looking into this? Are they latching onto your findings here? Because I think you're the pioneer here with regard to mining this data for this kind of information, aren't you?
I think there's more and more. My boss when I was at Google, Hal Varian, has been really a pioneer in this as well, mm-hmm. and measuring various economic outcomes such as automobile sales and housing sales and housing bubbles using some of this data. There are also people scraping websites to measure inflation differently. I think a lot of the traditional measures of the economy, even something like GDP or unemployment or the classic measures, when you see how they're actually constructed, they're not maybe as powerful as you might think, and they leave a lot to be desired. But kind of over time, we've ignored that because we need measures and we like having kind of clear numbers. Mm-hmm. So I think there's a lot more room for improvement in how we understand the economy through the internet.
Will we see in the next election cycles more pollsters and professional politicians and political parties looking at these Google searches and determining that candidate X versus Y searches are more prevalent than candidate Y versus X, and therefore, if I'm candidate Y, I need to change my strategy? Are we going to see more of that?
That's definitely one thing we'll see. I think another thing we'll see is using this to measure engagement and turnout. Again, as I said, you can't really trust surveys on who's going to vote in an election because people love saying they're going to vote in an election even if they're not. But you can see based on Google searches whether they're going to turn out searches for how to vote, where to vote. I think one thing that was very clear in this previous election was that African-American turnout was going to be way down, because you saw in places with huge African-American populations, in cities with huge African-American populations, there was an enormous drop in searches for voting information in the weeks leading up to the election. So Hillary Clinton's campaign, I think if they had seen this data, would have realized that they had a major issue in African-American engagement that they were maybe missing in the polls.
Well, that ties into Heidi's question on Twitter. She says, with regards to election turnout, do you see a difference between the Google data reflecting youth interest versus those that actually vote? This is not African-American. This is just youth. But can you see that? Can you bring that out in that data?
Yeah, you also saw that in the original Obama elections. There was this idea that there was going to be a huge surge in youth engagement, but you didn't really see that in the Google search data. And that's a big myth, that there was a big increase in young turnout for Obama. It never really materialized. So I think that's one classic area where you can't trust what people say and can instead use Google search data.
Okay, you say, and we've talked about this, that the most telling fact that you found regarding hate on the internet is the popularity of the N-word being used in Google searches. And you talk about racial bias and stereotypes and areas of the country in which the most racist internet searchers coincide with areas that underpay black people. In other words, if you're characterizing them as N-word, you're also underpaying these folks. But you also found another target of implicit prejudice that I think is going to shock a lot of people. Young girls. This speaks to how people feel about their children. What have you found?
Well, I think most parents would like to think that they treat their sons and daughters the same way. But if you look at everybody's aggregate anonymous Google searches, you can compare the Google searches that are questions about sons, is my son? And you can look at Google searches that are questions about daughters, is my daughter? And you see that there are different patterns in these searches. When parents in the United States, throughout the United States, ask questions about their son, they're more likely to ask, is my son gifted? Is my son a genius? Much more likely to ask that question about a son than a daughter. When they're asking about daughters, they're more likely to ask, is my daughter overweight? How to get my daughter to lose weight? So no matter what parents think, on average, they show a big bias. They're much more excited about the intellectual potential of their sons, much more concerned about the physical appearance of their daughters. That's one finding where I think just knowing that this truth about ourselves can maybe change the behavior. A lot of parents have told me after reading this that they're going to maybe try to catch themselves if they have these subconscious biases and say, are they paying enough attention to their daughters when they bring home a report card? Are they thinking, wait, is my daughter gifted? Is my daughter a genius? How can I get her into more engaging intellectual activities? So, I think just making this information available, I think, can help people, because I think parents don't want to have these biases, but they seem to be pretty deeply ingrained in many Americans.
Are these biases across the socioeconomic spectrum, or can you pinpoint them to certain parts of the spectrum?
My look at the data so far is that they're everywhere. So it doesn't seem they're just as high in Berkeley, California, or as in Mississippi, or anywhere in the United States. It doesn't seem to have to do with politics or education or anything. But I do hope that in the future, just making this data available, I think, will change some parents' behaviors and make sure that parents are taking the intellects of their daughters more seriously.
Well, if that self-knowledge can push people to make changes in their own behavior, why can't the knowledge gleaned about so many other things that you write about in this book also make people sit up and go, maybe I need to rethink how I think?
Yeah, I think it definitely is. I think one thing just in general is you have to be – I think we can be more compassionate to other people with this data. So you see, I've done so much research on depression and anxiety. I've done research on self-induced abortion. I think basically the United States right now has a self-induced abortion crisis that nobody's talking about because you see these searches in huge numbers for how to have a miscarriage, how to end a pregnancy, really, really troubling stuff, almost perfectly tracking places where it's become harder to get a legal abortion. This stuff is disturbing, but it also, I think, should make us more compassionate, because we don't usually see other people's struggles necessarily. People tend to hide their difficulties from us. But when you see everybody's Google search data, certainly myself, I think it has made me more compassionate and understanding to other people.
Well, another thing you talk about is there's a very big difference between what information you can glean about yourself and others through an analysis of Google searches versus going on Facebook. We are presenting our best selves to the Facebook world.
Yeah. So social media is – so I call Google search data digital truth serum, but social media data is digital brag to my friend serum. So people just kind of exaggerate how happy they are, how good their marriage is, how rich they are, how intellectual they are. You can compare different news sources. So the Atlantic Monthly and the National Enquirer. The National Enquirer actually sells more copies every year in the United States, but the Atlantic Monthly is 45 times more popular on Facebook because everybody wants their friends to know they're reading the Atlantic Monthly, but not if they're reading the National Enquirer. And you see people exaggerate how frequently they stay at luxury hotels rather than cheap budget hotels. And one of my favorite comparisons is the Facebook posts people make about their husbands, the social media posts people make about their husbands. The top ways they complete the phrase, my husband is, on social media. It's my husband is the best, my best friend, so cute, adorable, amazing. And then you compare that, so that's to their friends, public information. Then you compare that on Google searches when they're by themselves. People say when they talk about their husband, complaints about talking about their husband, it's my husband is a jerk, annoying, so mean, gay, very different picture of husbands on social media to their friends and on Google by themselves.
Do men make similar searches? My wife is?
Yeah. One of the top complaints. It's interesting. You can compare the different complaints that men and women make about their partners. So one comparison I compare is boring versus crazy. So women are much more likely to say that their husbands are boring than crazy. But men are much more likely to complain that their wives are crazy than boring. So I think women seem to want more excitement from their partner, and men maybe want less excitement from their partner.
Sex, or less drama, I guess. Sex is a big topic in your book, and that's because we do a lot of searching around the topic of sex and sexuality, evidently, on Google, far, far more than we've ever admitted to. How do you separate out curiosity in these searches? Simple curiosity. I'm reading about this in the paper, or I'm watching it on television. I've never thought about this. Let me search this out on Google. Versus our desire for something.
Yeah, I think we don't know for sure. But I also study not just Google. I studied Pornhub data and the videos that people watch. And mm-hmm. I think when people are actually watching a video, that gets pretty into the realm of desire relative to curiosity. Although you never know for sure, but definitely we do learn from this data, and really, I think a revolutionary development in the social sciences, the sex on the internet, that sexuality is very different from what we've traditionally thought and traditionally been told.
So, what are we lying to ourselves about when it comes to sex, and what are you uncovering here? And be careful.
Well, it depends on the person. Yeah, it depends on the person. So one area is definitely homosexuality. There are people still in the United States, although it's gotten better, who are I think clearly in the closet in places where it's hard to be gay. You do see a higher prevalence of gay porn searches than would be led on from surveys or Facebook or social media or dating sites. So I think that's one area. And then I think I'll be careful and just let people read the book if they want to learn a lot more about sexuality.
One of the things I think is curious that you talk about condom use and people's self-reported use of condoms. And if you add up all the self-reporting use of condoms and then you compare that to condom sales, it's not true. We're not using them.
Yeah, we actually exaggerate how many condoms we use. I think that doesn't mean it's not clear from that. Does that mean we're exaggerating how frequently we have safe sex or how frequently we have sex in general? I think it's more people exaggerate how much sex they have in general, because even if you look at how much people say they have sex with no contraception and a woman of pregnancy age, if people are really having that much sex, there would be more pregnancies every year in the United States. I think in the United States now, there is pressure to be having a lot of sex, and people exaggerate how much they're having. And you also see this on Google, where the number one complaint about a marriage by far is that it's a sexless marriage, much more common than complaints about a loveless marriage or an unhappy marriage.
Hmm. Where do you take this research into this new behavioral frontier?
I think we're going to see it's a really exciting area. If you are, you know, I kind of talk about some of the classic social scientists, and I talk about Freud a lot in the book, and you know, I actually test with the data some of his theories. You know, I got a data set of dreams and typos, and I talk about Freudian slips, and you know, and what we dream about, and all this stuff. And I think it is really exciting if you are into human behavior and human psychology. A lot of the greatest scholars in this area haven't really had great data when they've been making their theories. So they've kind of just been theorizing without much in the way of ways to test it. But I think now we do have ways to really test kind of all these theories and really learn, maybe for the first time, who we are as a society.
You conclude this book with two paragraphs I've never seen in print before. One of the points of this book is that we have to follow the big data wherever it leads and act accordingly. I may hope that most readers are going to hang on my every word and try to direct patterns linking the final pages to what happened earlier. But no matter how hard I work on polishing my prose, most people are going to read the first 50 pages, get a few points, and move on with their lives. Thus, I conclude this book in the only appropriate way. By following the data, what people actually do, not what they say, I'm going to get a beer with some friends and stop working on this damn conclusion. Too few of you, big data tells me, are still reading. So are people going to use this information productively, do you think, in 10 seconds or less?
People tend not to read books. That's another thing you learn in big data. But they sometimes do buy them without reading them, so I hope
Seth,
everybody does.
Seth,